Hello, and welcome to Python 411, Computer Programming for Everybody. Well, today we're going to have another lecture by Dr. Sergio Rey on modules. And I think that modules are an overlooked aspect of Python sometimes. At least for me, they were. When I first started learning Python, I think I skipped the chapter on modules in the first couple books I read because I thought classes are important and many other things, but modules, I wasn't so sure. Well, they're an essential part of Python, and they're part of the philosophy of doing proper Python programming. So I did a presentation on Python modules a long time ago as one of my podcasts, but this is a much more complete coverage of the topic, and I think that it's a great review for most of us, and for people who are just learning Python, this is a very important exercise. And so this is a relatively long podcast, but very, very educational. I do intend to get back to some interviews very, very soon. I'm working on some exciting interviews, I must say. But for today, we're going to alternate it with another educational tutorial type thing, graciously allowed to be used from Dr. Sergio Rey of San Diego State University. So without further ado, here we go with his presentation on Python modules.
Today we're going to talk about modules, using documentation conventions in Python that help us test and document our code. And then, so modules, what are they? Think about a module as just a file. It's just a source file. That's the simplest way. But they play a bunch of functions. Each module with the .py extension is just a text file with Python syntax inside it. Okay, and we call that a module. A program, like we're going to be writing in a couple weeks, a big program, therefore is typically going to rely on a bunch of different modules in the same program. Right, so to do something complex, we're going to rely on several different modules in the same program. So you might be running one, quote, module, stars.py, for example, but behind the scenes, it's making use of a lot of different modules. Okay? So modules can use other modules. Those modules can be built-in modules, meaning when you download Python, you get those modules for free. They're not third-party or extension modules, and there's a lot of those built-in modules. But as we'll see, you can also build your own modules to extend Python. And those modules, these extension modules, could be done in a different language, say do C or Fortran or C++ and compile a module. Or they could actually just be pure Python that you write to do some specialized tasks, and you create a new module. Right? You have a lot of flexibility.
What's the difference between modules to use other modules and the module to be extension?
These guys, modules can use other modules. That just means my module can use other modules. How those other modules are built is they're either already part of Python, they're built-in modules, or they're modules that somebody else had built. So they're two separate concepts. This just means one module can use a bunch of other different modules. These two lines are distinguishing about where these other modules come from. Are they built in or are they third-party extension modules? Now, why do you use modules? They play a bunch of useful functions. First, it's a good way to organize related code. So if you have a bunch of classes or methods for variables that you use for certain types of problem solving, and you're going to reuse this code, you want to group them together in the same module. All right? It's also a way to modularize a complex program. We said that a program can use a bunch of modules. And if we have a complex program, rather than having that program be one huge massive script, 7,000 line script, that's a nightmare to maintain, you can decompose it into related sections. And each one of those sections moves into its own module. And it's much easier to get the big picture that way and maintain and extend that program than if it's all one big script. All right, so think about your hard drive, for example. What would you rather have? One flat file system where everything's in one directory or folder, or a hierarchical system where you can nest things inside of other things to organize your thoughts. Code reuse. If we think about this large program, let's say we're going to write our own visualization system. That visualization system is going to have to do things like read data sets in, generate some views. Each part, each of those two tasks could be useful in other contexts. There's other types of programs we'd like to write that have to read in data, not just our visualization system. So if we are clever in writing our visualization system in a modular fashion, that module for data input-output can be used by other programs, not just our visualization program. And modules let us do that. And then finally, as we'll see today, modules in Python are the way namespaces are managed. And namespaces basically have to do with when you ask for something at the interpreter, when you type a name, the namespace governs how Python looks for that, any objects that have that name. Now, when we have very complex programs using lots of modules, namespaces become very important. They can also become a source of confusion and trip us up. But we'll see today how this works, what are namespaces, how do they work, why would you want to use namespaces, and what do you have to be careful about when you're using multiple modules to build up a big program. Okay? If you go to the Python homepage and look at the official documentation, there's a section called Library Reference that lists all the modules. And this was for my installation. This is cut, so there's a bunch more down here and here. I counted them. There's 360 modules that come for the Python that's installed on the TigerBox. If you did it for a Windows machine, you're going to get about the same amount. So these are all modules. Each one of them is basically a Python file that has several functions or classes or variables that are useful for that problem domain that module is designed to deal with. So you get over 360 of these when you download Python. So there's a lot in the library already, a lot in the language already. This is where the notion of batteries included, which is a slogan of Python, comes from. There's a lot in there. Next week, it's got trim. There's a couple of visualization toolkits down here. One of them is tkinter. That is a module that we get for free when we download Python. Now, not every program that we write with Python has to do a GUI. And therefore, you wouldn't want to load that library, that module, every time you start Python if you don't need it. This setup allows us to pull in the modules that we need on an as-needed basis. Okay? So there's a lot of them that do all kinds of stuff. So how do you use modules? They're good things, but there's a lot of different ways you can interact with them. So we want to explore those today. All right, we're going to write a simple little script, a module called mymon.py. And all it does is define a new function called shout. Shout's going to take an argument, which is a string message. And we're simply going to have that message set to uppercase. We're going to print it. All right, so it's a silly function, but the point is just to illustrate how modules work. Okay, so that's our mymodule.py. This is our wonderful contribution that maybe will be in the next version of Python. We have this appearing in the list of 361. I don't think so, but that's the idea. This would be a script someone's going to write to use our module. So the module that we're making available to the world is mymodule.py. The only thing it has in it is this one function called shout. So how could someone use it? There's different ways to refer and use modules in other modules. This is called the import statement. So this is a separate module. This is a different script called import example.py. And it's going to use our module with this form, import then module name. So this tells the interpreter, look for a module called my module and import it into the namespace, the namespace where this script is being run. So import module name. We could add other modules here. We could say import my module, comma OS, comma sys, comma TK enter. If we wanted more modules, you can do them on one line, separated by commas. Once we do this, it's as if you want to think about it loosely, we took whatever was in myModule.py and basically typed it in here in a sense. So it's as if you're cutting and pasting behind the scenes. Not exactly, but loosely speaking. Then we create a variable, which is a string. Now we're going to use the shout function from our module. So our module is an object. Everything in Python is an object. But this illustrates that we're using the myModule namespace to call the function shout, which is defined in that module. All right, so we import the module, and then we're going to use module name dot whatever we want from that module. If we didn't have this line, and we tried this, we'd get an error, because this is not in the namespace yet. That import statement gets the module into the namespace. And if we run this file at the interpreter, import.example, Python minus I, it works. Okay, so it takes our message, which was all lowercase, and our function just makes it uppercase and prints it. Okay, so this is at the interpreter.
If we are not using minus I, we'll still get the same message?
Yeah. Minus I, what this does is, once you execute the script, I cut it off, you'd be still in the Python interpreter. If we didn't have the minus I, it would run the script and you'd be back at the command line, the shell, not in Python. So the I is the way to get back to the interpreter, if you want to. Okay? So what does that import statement do? A couple things. It actually creates a protected namespace inside the namespace of the module that is calling the import. So there's two namespaces at work for our import example. The import example namespace, which is the global namespace, and then the my module namespace. They're both available to us now. But we saw that we couldn't say shout, we had to say my module.shout, because we're going inside the namespace for the imported module. And inside that namespace are all the attributes, the classes, the functions, the variables that are defined in the module that you're importing. Okay? So that's what our namespace is. It's where we can look up stuff for that module. There's a second way to deal with imports, and these are not necessarily preferred over one or the other. This is how we did it last time, but we can use what's known as an alias. So we can say import my module as MM. And then everywhere we want to refer to my module, we just type MM instead. And therefore, the script is pretty much the same, it's just much shorter. We don't have to type out my module.shout. We just use MM.shout. We didn't mess with our module that's using. We didn't mess with our magic module here. And we're going to get the same result. The only difference is with an alias, it just creates a new space with a different name. Rather than the namespace name being my module, it's now whatever the abbreviation was we wanted to use, MM, for example. And works the same way, but it's very useful when you have really long module names, which you can have at times. We'll see some later today. So it's useful to abbreviate those, but still have a protected namespace. All right, a third way to use modules inside other modules is with the from statement. And the syntax is from module name, import, attribute, or object, or class, or function. So we're saying from my module, import shout, the object called shout. Happens to be a function, but it works as long as it's in the namespace. And now we can use shout directly. We no longer need to access it through the my module namespace since we've used the from statement. So it's a different different access mechanism. But results the same.
But if we do that, we will override in our code. If we use another shell, then it will be overlaid.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that, yeah. Did you read the notes?
No.
Okay. All right. As Jingyu said, this can cause problems. So if we have a second script that's like the first script that uses from my module import shout, but before we did the import, in the script we had to find our own shout. So there's a local shout inside this module import example 3 that works like this. We can certainly call it here, but after this import, shout is going to be the shout in our my module, in the imported module, not this shout, not the local one. And this is a namespace clash. And it's last defined, since it's a dynamically typed language, shout is now going to be my module.shout, not our local shout. So when we run this, we should have seen, we were expecting to see this twice. That's the local shout, but we get the shout from my module because of the from import approach. So how do you fix that? There's a couple of ways to fix it. We could use an alias with the from import. So down here, this is the same, but we're going to rename it. We're going to rename the object as new shout. And then we call new shout down here. So this shout is going to be this one, and this shout will be this one. This shout is no longer the myModule.shout. And then it works. So that's the local one, the myModule, and then the local one. Right, so namespaces are a way that you can protect things. You may want to use the same name for a function or a class in multiple modules. And that's fine. Where the complications come in is when you want to use those modules together inside of another module, then you have to protect the namespaces. Otherwise, you can only use that variable or class name or object name only once. So namespaces can be very useful. It's tempting to not worry about it and use what we're going to call the kitchen sink approach, where you just import everything and pollute the namespace. And there's some modules that actually ask you to do that, but it can cause you grief, because it's very difficult to track down where the bugs are if you run into bugs. All right, another way to fix it, that same problem, is to use the alias on the module rather than using an alias on the object that you're importing. So here we import the module as mm, we saw that before. Then we can call mm shout method or shout function. It's not a class, it's a module. And we're good to go. Local my mod.shout and then local shout. Alright? The kitchen sink approach. The last way you can pull modules into other modules is with this asterisk business. From module name import star, it's a meta character, says import everything from that module into the local namespace. All the classes, all the methods, all the variables, they all get imported. Okay? So this is a different script. We create a new string here and a new method, how long. Now, my module 2 is importing everything from my module.py. Then we have a third script that's going to use my module 2. It's going to import everything from my module 2, but my module 2 is importing everything from my module 1. All right, and then how does this work? Well, in our program, this would be the global program we're going to run, we're importing everything from module 2. We have a string we're going to call shout. Now that shout, this is my comment to remind me what's going on. This is the shout function that lives inside of my module 2. How long? That is a function that lives in my module 2. And shout, oh, some message was here, this guy. And shout is from my module, not from my module 2. but it comes through my module 2, because my module 2 is importing everything from my module. So it all works as planned, it's just that the imports get pretty complex. You can have circular references, modules importing from other modules, importing from other modules. Okay? So you can do this. And Python's pretty good about circular references. What would be a circular reference? If you had three modules, say module A, module B, module C, and module B imported from module A, and module A imported from module C, right? And then module C imports from module A, and module B imports from module C, you won't run into recursion problems. Python will only get the first time a module imports from another module and stop for you. It's more conceptually for you, trying to keep it straight can be tricky. Okay? So you can import, you can have modules work with other modules two basic ways, with import and with from import. It's a good habit to always use the namespace version though. Import module name, and then you always have to use module name dot object. So you never run into this clash of namespaces. It's more typing, but it keeps you sane.
In module 2,
mm-hmm.
you had...
This guy?
Yeah. If you had done here import my modules mm,
yeah.
then in your program, would you have mm.shout?
We'd have to, yeah, we'd have to have mm.shout because shout would not have been defined, so we'd get a trace back.
Do you encourage you, we do something like that, import module to module, then module to next module?
Yeah, that's fine. Just, this is bad juju. Import star. You could say import my module is preferable. And then we'd have to use, like Charlie said, my module.shout. That would work.
Because from my module import, like the star actually is equal to import on. Because if I do that, I can directly use access the property of that module.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If we do it this way, and let's say there was a how long method in my module, right? Mm-hmm. Then for the user, when someone imports from my module 2, they're going to use this how long method, not the one in my module, if you go this route. Because it's no longer, you have a namespace clash.
How are the paths defined for importing modules?
Okay, when you're at the interpreter or you're running this, import example 5, and example 5 is this, import my module. Python first looks in the current directory that you're working in. So wherever I executed Python file name, you're in that, that's the current working directory. Python first checks to see if there's a file called mymodule.py in that directory. And if it is, it uses that for the import. If there is not a mymodule.py there, then it looks in what's known as a syspath, the Python syspath, and that's defined at runtime. If you import sys and type sys.path, it'll have a long, it's a list of paths that your Python installation will look and search through to find an object you're referencing. Okay? And we can modify that to have our custom, let's say we build up a bunch of Python scripts that we want to use, they're general utility scripts. We can change the syspath to have our own customized directory. Or you can mess with the way Python's installed on your hard drive and add stuff into the directories in there. Okay? Other questions on modules? It's a lovely color.
I have a question. What's the first shout method? Here, use a message then. The bottom two use MSG. What's the difference?
MSG is this variable.
Uh-huh.
Message is from my module 2. That's why I wrote these comments. So message is defined in this module. It's a different variable.
Yeah, you can also define relative paths, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, you can use relative paths too. Okay, so that modules are very useful. As with everything, it's easy to test it out and see if you're doing what you think is right. Just fire up the interpreter and test it. Documentation. A couple things to cover. Documentation strings, also known as doc strings, people call them. These, if we do them a certain way, actually become attributes of the function or class that you're writing, which is really useful and turns out to be really powerful for us. What we should get in the habit of doing is for anything we're going to potentially reuse down the line, us or somebody else, a colleague, we should add a doc string to, if we're defining a new function for a new class, we should document it with a doc string because it helps us remember what this thing is supposed to do, how it does it, so that 6 months later we remember. Okay. It's a very useful convention to get into. And if we write our doc strings a certain way, then we can exploit these hooks that are built into Python to make life easier for the user of our function or class or method or our own selves. Very, very useful thing. So how does it work? We have a simple module here that only has one function. Simple function is just going to print length of a message in characters. These three double quotes down to these three double quotes, this is one big string. And if it appears as the first line underneath the def statement, Python treats it as the doc string for that function or method if this is inside of a class. So this is the attribute for the doc, right from here to there. That's an attribute called dot underscore underscore doc underscore underscore for how long? All right? We can put anything we want in there, in the string. But the purpose of a doc string, the convention is you always have one single line that summarizes what this thing is, what it does. And don't repeat its name because that's redundant. So you just say what it does. Then white space, and if it's a function and it takes arguments, you might say these are the argument names and this is what data types they're supposed to be. And if the function returned anything, you would say returns whatever, explain what comes back. And then some notes to the user. All right? So this was a note just to me that there's no error checking here. We're assuming people behave well and put a string through. It might work great with the tuple or dictionary, but that's not what it's intended for. And then our doc string ends right here. That's the end of the doc string. This is the function. And our function is going to build up a string where message, the argument that's passed in, is supposed to be a string. What we're going to do first is figure out how long it is, call the len function. That tells us how many characters are in this message. That becomes an integer. So this becomes an integer. And we're going to insert it into the string at this position. And then tuck that away in a string. Last thing our function does is print that string. So it's a pretty simple function, a lot more in the doc string than actually in the code. So if we play by the rules and define our doc strings this way, what does it get us? The first thing it gets us is that if we're in a Python interpreter, we can call help on that module. And what it will do is extract the doc string verbatim. We don't have to open up an editor and edit the module. Right? We just use the online help system and it can parse it for us. There's other utilities as well, a thing called PyDoc. That will generate HTML, really pretty color syntax of your modules if you have doc strings in them. Okay? So this is just our doc string. The other nice thing doc strings do for us is they work closely with some of the utilities one has to test Python code as you develop it. And there's two modules, doc test, which we're going to look at today. This works directly with the doc strings, and it's very lightweight. The problem with testing frameworks is sometimes there's a lot of setup you have to do to write the test scripts rather than the code you want to build. And actually, and what that means is people tend not to write test scripts. They just write code. And it goes untested. So you want a framework that's easy to use so that you're encouraged to use it. And DocTest is pretty simple to use, and it saves you a lot of headaches. It allows you to do testing. There's a more powerful module called Unit Test that's much more heavyweight, a lot more complex, to be honest, to use than the DocTest module. It builds on DocStrings, so it can integrate what we're going to look at today. And if you're going to do a lot of complex Python programming, if you're doing stuff for production systems where your job depended on it, you would use unit testing. Okay? But for today, doc testing will get us where we want to go. So let's say we wanted to develop a new module that got around the zero offset problem in Python. Well, it's not a problem, that's the way language is designed, but normal humans think about one as the first number, not zero, right? When we want to get a bunch of objects, so give me the first one, don't give me the zeroth one. So we could write a little function that deals with unit offset instead of zero offset. And what we have to do is pass in the sequence object that we want to take stuff out of, and then the position that we want to pull it out of. Right, so if we had a non-zero offset language, say a language where the first thing had an index of 1, not 0, that's what we're doing here. We're going to make Python a 1 offset language. This is our doc string from here to here. So the first statement is returns the if element of a 0 offset sequence. And here is a little example. Now this is a new feature of doc strings that we can use with the doc test module. This was just cut and paste, these three lines, from the interpreter. So I built my function before I put the doc string in, and I ran it, and I tested it at the interpreter to make sure it works. So I ran the script, then I defined z, just like that. Then I called my function with z, and I said, get me the first element. And I got 0, which is right. So it works great. It works just like I wanted it to do. Then I cut and paste from the interpreter these three lines and put them in the doc string. So I had a shell running and my editor editing this module. I copied and pasted it into the module. So this is actually from the terminal. Okay, and if it's in the doc string, then this module doctest parses the doc strings and searches for these three angles. And when it finds them, it says, aha, this is intended to be executed as a test string. So let's execute it and see if this function does what the great developer says it's supposed to. So the great developer saying that if you pass in a sequence of the numbers 0 through 9 and you call our function and ask for the first one, you are going to get back 0. This is like the guide to this function. Then, this is the end of our function. Okay, this is the infrastructure we need to use this doc test thing. So this is not part of our function. This is just setting up a second function which basically wraps around what we want to test. So this is the way you set things up. You define a private function called test. You import the doc test module. That's the Python module that allows us to test doc strings. We import this module. We import itself. This is the module we're working in, the one we want to test. And then this function returns doctest when we're calling its test module method on doctest. This little guy is at the bottom of our module. And that is a trick that tells Python, how is this module being used? If we're at the interpreter and we say python.testex.py, the name of the module is now this. And that tells Python, this module is being used all by itself. It is not being used as an imported module. If we had another module that said import doctest.expy, this would be false. All this does is check, is this module being run as a standalone module, or is it being used inside of another module? You only do the testing for standalones, because all you care about is this little segment of the world right now. We want to make sure it works the way we intended before we start using it in other modules. Okay? Questions so far?
Well, we need to define a private, like a test function.
We don't have to call it private, but it's just a test we're going to run on this module. So it's just convention. But we could have called it whatever we wanted. Flip a coin and it would have worked. All right, then we want to test our module. This is at a shell, python.test.py. I run it, nothing happens, which is good. It means that behind the scenes, those tests were run and they worked like they said they were going to work. So nothing is reported. So silence is golden here. If the doc string, if this returns, say, 40 when I called it, there would be a conflict and then I would get a bunch of noise right after this, if there was a problem. If there was a conflict between what the documentation says that function's going to do and what it actually does, it would show up there. But since there's not, everything's fine. The minus V is verbose. And this is actually printing out everything that was going on behind the scenes up here. You just don't see it. But with the minus V flag, it's verbose. So what's going on is that it's trying the doc string. It's looking for those angle brackets. It finds the first line, actually executes it. And it doesn't return anything, so it says expecting nothing. Okay, we didn't get anything. Then we're trying the next thing, which was calling the function unit off as Z and 1. And it says we're expecting a 0. Okay, meaning we got a 0. And then it summarizes. So two items had no tests. One item passed all tests. Two tests and doc, blah, blah, blah. Two tests and three items. Two passed. This is the critical line. 0 failures. So everything's hunky-dory. The doc strings are accurate. They're explaining how that function works. That's really useful because programmers have a earned reputation for not doing any documentation because they'd rather write programs, spend their time writing programs than writing documentation. When they do write documentation, it's usually a one-shot deal. And it gets out of date really quickly. They might add new features, not document them, or change the way the function actually behaves and it no longer matches the doc string. This is intended to make sure the docs match the behavior of your functions. And since they do, everything passes. Now, to give you an example of something breaking, let's say I was working with some colleagues and they originally came up with this method, but then I was monkeying with it because I might have had a more clever idea, I thought, and I changed the logic. It should be I minus 1, but I broke it. Not intentionally, it could have been a mistake. All right. I didn't change the doc string, however. The doc string is expecting a 0 when you use this function. But because I changed the behavior of the function, now when we run our doc string, when we run our test, it catches the problem. It says, hey, we were expecting a 0 at that point, but we got a 1. There's a conflict between the doc string and the way the function behaves. There's something wrong. Go back and fix it. Again, it forces you to make sure things match up. All right, so by getting rid of that minus 1, I broke it. But because I have the doc string, I would see that I broke it. I wouldn't have to spend a week trying to figure out why this worked last week, what happened. It's pretty clear what happened because I know it broke right here. You can have 100 functions in your module. Each of them can be tested. So I can't put 100 on the screen. All right, so this is really, really handy, and it's something you got to force yourself initially to do, but it can save you a lot of headache down the road.
I think the most useful thing of this is help us debug some logical error. because sometimes the code still run, and you mm-hmm. change something, it's run, and later you get some unexpected results, and you don't know why
yeah.
it happened.
Yeah. Folks, some people argue, sort of the extreme programming types argue that when you're writing code, what you should do is actually write the doc string first. Say, this is what I want to happen, and then make it happen, as opposed to writing the logic and then hoping that it works the way you want it to. So they say, write the test first, and then implement the behavior that passes this test. And it's an interesting way to think about it, because usually that's what you want to do. You have a design floating around your head, but unless you think about how the user's going to use it and what you want to happen, you might start programming and go off in a different direction. If you force yourself to say, all right, I want to write this function so that if the user uses it this way, I get back a zero, because that's what I want to happen. So we write the doc string first, and then we get, okay, now how do we make that happen? Then we work on that part. Run the doc string. Okay, we're done, at least with that part. So a lot more work up front, but it can save you work down the line.
If you import that module into a bigger application, it won't run the test, right?
It will not run the test. So let me just finish this part and we'll go back to it. This, when you have a failure, you get a lot more information. So I had to put it on two screens. It said this is where there was a problem. And then the summary, you had a failure. So it catches your attention right away that something went wrong. Yeah, if we import this module into another module, the test never gets run, because this statement right here would be false. That's what this little hook does.
It means after we write each module, we need to test the standalone, just for each module, to make sure it did the thing we want to do.
Right. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, but it's good practice to do it. I mean, you can get away with not testing. You can try and get away with not testing, but eventually it could come back to bite you. Other questions on testing?
And I found on the screen it said no tests. What does that mean? I mean, the, go one. Oh, two items have no tests.
Yeah, there's two items. The module itself, this is the name of the module. And there's no test up. You can have a doc string up here at the top of the module. Mm-hmm. But there's, I didn't put one, so that's why it said it didn't find anything. And then this one, one of these didn't. I can't remember which one it was. The test one has no string, no doc string. So this doesn't have a doc string. Mm-hmm. You could probably put one in there, but I don't know. Why did you want to do that? Okay. This is a whole other lecture, so why don't we cover this in the lab? We'll take a break and then come back and do this over in the lab. Any questions?
This would only work for terminal output, though, right? Standard output. You couldn't test and get ready to file or ready to screen.
Yeah. You'd have to go around it, basically read the file and then compare it against the, yeah. The unit the other guy, unit tests, you have those hooks, but it's a lot more overhead. Okay? So let's say about 10 after.